The honeybee is in crisis. The deaths and slow decline of a small, stinging insect can seem hardly worth noticing when the world is faced with so many disasters of the moment. But our guest this morning says the devastation of honeybees affects the way the world eats, how much we pay for our food, and a lot more. Good morning, I'm Veronica Rickert, and I'm glad to be with you here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our guest this morning is Hannah Nordhaus. She's the author of The Beekeeper's Lament, How One Man and Half a Million Bees Help Feed America. A historian by training, her work has appeared in the Financial Times, the Los Angeles Times, and the Village Voice. And we'd love to hear from you today. Your questions and comments about bee biology and the impact of bees are welcome at 1-800-642-1234. Or send your email to talk@wpr.org. And you can also find us on Facebook at wpr.org/Rickert. And Hannah Nordhaus, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me on the show, Veronica.
Well, you start your book by introducing us to a pretty unique character who goes by the name of John Miller. He's an itinerant beekeeper. Can you tell us about him and his job?
Yeah, so John Miller has 10,000 beehives. Actually, I think he now has 11,000. He's had a good year. And he hauls them all over, mostly around the West. He takes them to California for the winters. They start in February, and they pollinate almonds. And then they move sort of up and down the West Coast, pollinating cherries and apples in Washington State. And then he brings them to North Dakota for the summers, where they feast on clover and alfalfa. And then in the fall and early winter, he stores them in potato cellars in Idaho.
In potato cellars in Idaho.
It's
kind of a great image of millions of bees tucked away in a potato cellar.
Yeah.
Well, one of the things that was a revelation to me about this book, I mean, I knew that bees pollinated and were important to the ecosystem, but I didn't know that there were these people who went around and helped Mother Nature along.
Yeah, I had no idea either before I got started with this project. There are probably a little more than 1,000 commercial beekeepers who take their bees, haul them on semi-trucks, and bring them from crop to crop. And about one-third of the foods we eat, fruits and vegetables that we eat, need to be pollinated by bees to produce in the quantities that we are accustomed to eating in. So they're a pretty essential cog in the wheel of modern agriculture, and very few people know that.
Do you have a sense of how long that sort of beekeeping has been going on?
The pollination industry, sort of pollination rentals is what they call it, where farmers pay beekeepers to bring hives to their crops. The first known pollination rental was in 1909, I believe, in New Jersey, I think in an apple orchard. But it wasn't a big income stream for beekeepers in any way until the 1970s, I believe, when the almond industry started growing up in California, and almond pollen is really heavy. It can't be carried on the wind, and the trees can't pollinate themselves. They need pollinators, and there's just been more and more acres of these almonds planted, and there's just no way to get the trees to bear fruit, bear nuts, unless beekeepers bring in the bees. So starting in the 70s, they started paying these guys like $8 a hive in the beginning, and now it's somewhere between $150 and $200 per hive.
Per hive.
Yeah.
Wow.
For 3 weeks of almond bloom in February.
Well, before we go any further, if we could brush up our high school biology on what pollination is and how the bees do it, and I guess why it matters.
Okay, so pollination is the way that flowers reproduce, and pollinators, bees, and there are also lots of other natural pollinators like bumblebees and butterflies, birds, hummingbirds, for instance. What they do is they visit a flower. A lot of times they visit the flower because of the nectar, that's the stuff that becomes honey, and that's what's appealing to the bees. They also eat pollen as well. They go to one flower, they visit it, they collect the nectar and pollen, and then they go to another flower, and so doing, they bring the pollen from one flower to the next. So I think it's from the pistil, which is the male part of the flower, to the stigma, which is the female part. And that's how new flowers get made. So bees are lured by nectar, and then they bring that back to the hive, and they sort of rub the pollen off on each other and then visit other flowers, and that's how flowers perpetuate themselves.
You know, it's such a beautiful piece of biology that the bees are going and they're helping flowers to bloom. It seems so idyllic. And then you get to the place we are right now, which is the collapse of the bee population in America. What is going on there? Why the cause for concern right now?
Well, bees have been struggling for the last 20 years, but it's become a really big deal in the last 5 years because of this new disease that nobody quite understands called colony collapse disorder. And the first time anybody noticed it was in late 2006. A beekeeper named Dave Hackenberg visited some hives in Florida and realized that while his queen was still there and a few of her attendants and the brood were still in their little cells waiting to hatch and there was lots of honey, there were no adult bees. All the foragers had flown off and disappeared. And he had never seen anything like this, and he contacted some bee scientists, and they had never seen anything like this. And they came to realize that it was happening to a lot of beekeepers. And so that year and the next, I think about 30% of the nation's bees died of colony collapse. And in the years since, that's been about the number that's been dying. It hasn't always been because of colony collapse disorder. There's a lot of other troubling things going on. But every year since 2007, about 30% of the nation's bees have died off each year.
That's incredible.
Yeah, it's hard. I mean, of course, bees die. That's what they do. And beekeepers were accustomed to somewhere around 10% losses each year, 10 to 15. 15 was a bad year. And now, 15 is a great year, and they'll lose 30 to 40. Some of these guys have lost 90% of their bees to CCD in recent years. So it's really, it's hard to sustain a business when you have to pay to restock your bees like that every year.
Well, in that story you told about the beekeeper whose bees just flew off, that was incredibly mysterious at the time, because if you know anything about the social habits of bees, they are all about their colony. They live there. They're very duty driven. And for them to just fly off and leave was just beyond mysterious for these beekeepers.
Yeah, it's very eerie and very unsettling, and bees just don't do that. And, of course, bees do leave. If they're sick, they will leave the hive to die. But typically when a hive is sick, when a colony is sick, you'll see dead bees at the entrance, and you'll sort of see evidence of what's been going on. And what was so unsettling in this case is that they just were gone.
So I guess we arrive at the question then. I mean, this is obviously a devastating thing for beekeepers and for people who grow crops that rely on these itinerant pollination services. But what about the rest of us? Does it impact me when I go to the grocery store? What's the real world impact?
Well, as I said, honeybees pollinate a lot of crops. They pollinate 1 out of 3 bites that we eat. And a lot of the really good stuff, like cherries, berries, all the pit fruits, all the vine fruits. So were the honeybee to disappear, our diet we would not starve, but our diet would be a lot less interesting. But right now, I will say, there's been a lot of media about how honeybees are disappearing. In fact, the number of honeybees in the country has stayed steady, but at great expense to beekeepers, because they have had to restock their hives and pay more money to get the same amount of bees they had the year before. And so far, it seems they've been doing it, and they are well compensated for pollinating almonds, and I think that helps them, but it's also sort of hurts them, because the almonds are one of the reasons that their bees are dying, because they're just getting so sick. But, so right now, it's not making our food more expensive in any way, it's still available, but it's just long term, it's not sustainable for beekeepers. So we have to try to find a way to keep the bees alive.
So what do scientists think is going on with the decline of honeybees?
Well, there's a few things. So in addition to colony collapse disorder, which is still a mystery to them, they don't know. There's some supposition, and what they're thinking now is it's a combination of probably a fungal infection and some viruses, but there's also some suspicion it might be pesticides. They're wondering how nutrition factors in, because as bees are carried from one crop to another, they don't have a very varied diet. They eat one thing straight for 3 weeks. So CCD is still a mystery. There's also something called a varroa mite, which is a really nasty little parasite. It's like a little tick, and it sucks. It latches onto the bees' backs and abdomens, and sucks the life out of the bee, and then the hive, and then ultimately, you know, a beekeeping outfit. And that was actually first found in Wisconsin in the 1980s. And since then it's spread throughout the nation, and it's really, I mean, if you ask John Miller, the beekeeper in my book, the biggest problem that he faces as a beekeeper, he would not say colony collapse disorder. He would say it's the varroa mite. And they've managed to control it with medications, but a few years before colony collapse hit, the medication they were using stopped working and the mites became resistant. And so I think he feels that the varroa mite is probably a factor in these other die-offs. I mean, they've just been really struggling to keep their bees alive. And there have been some advances in the science with varroa mites. There's a new product on the market, which is more natural, a lot easier to use for beekeepers. And John Miller, I know, has great hope that that will make his job easier. But so far, it's tough every year. They never know what they're going to suffer from, but it always is something. In some section of the country, beekeepers are having awful die-offs every year.
Well, it doesn't sound like the easiest life. I mean, if you've got a family, you're on the road chasing flowers 8 months of the year. You can see why the people who do this, they have to deal with the varroa mite and a whole lot more. It sounds like their numbers are declining, too.
Yeah, before the varroa mite, in the early 1980s, there were about 5,000 commercial beekeepers in the country, and that's defined as people who have 3,000 or more hives. And when I wrote the book, these numbers haven't been updated for a couple of years, that the number had dropped to about 1,200, and I would not be surprised if it's dropped below that now, because it's so hard. You know, it's grueling physically. You get stung. You're lifting these huge hives all the time. You're traveling. You're away from your family. And your bees are dying, and it's really expensive to keep them alive now and to restock once you have lost your bees. So it's not for the faint of heart.
Why do they do it? Did you get a sense of that, what it is they feel for the bees and this lifestyle?
Yeah, I mean, there's a guy, Pat Hykem. He's a queen breeder, and I spent some time with him, and he always says it's the passion thing. they just love bees. You know, you don't do something like beekeeping because you're a sensible person. You do it because it's what you feel called to do. And, I say in the book, I feel some kinship with these guys, because as a writer, you know, we're not too sensible either. We're not the smartest tools in the shed. We've chosen a profession that never makes a lot of money and is lonely and not always that rewarding. But ultimately, you do these things because you feel drawn to them. And beekeepers are just, they are so passionate about what they do, and they love the bees. And John Miller, my guy, he loves his bees. He always says he can't wait to lift the lid of a hive and see what's going on there and see how they're doing. And he loves honey, too. That's another thing that he just adores honey, and he thinks that it's such a miracle to make that and sell that to the public, and so it's his calling.
In terms of colony collapse disorder, what we were talking about a minute ago, do you have a sense about whether that is something that's focused on North America, United States, or is that something that's we're seeing worldwide?
It is worldwide. It's sort of weird, and I haven't looked at recent numbers. It's because it's such a vague disorder, it's sort of hard to tell what's actually colony collapse and what is just someone's bees died and they came there 3 weeks later and all the bees were gone. But, it's not necessarily colony collapse disorder. But, as of when I wrote the book, there it had been found in 36 states, but not in every state, and in India and in parts of Europe, but not everywhere. So, and not in Australia. I don't believe in New Zealand. So it's sort of spotty, and its geographical distribution is as mysterious as its symptoms and its causes.
You must have gone out with some of these guys, as I know you did, to look at their bees. What was it like for you coming from the outside? I mean, do you still have that sort of knee-jerk reaction of, oh my gosh, it's a bee, I'm going to get stung?
No. I mean, I guess I'm a little smarter about when I'm going to get stung. going out for your first time, I guess it's weird. I didn't find it that frightening. I didn't, I, you know, I had never been stung by a bee before I started this project, and can't say that now. I have been stung since. But, you know, I went in there, and I just sort of felt like I was going to be safe. You know, John Miller, who I wrote the book about, he's a very eloquent and enthusiastic spokesman for the bee. And he, you know, was very reassuring, and he set me up in a bee suit. You know, you wear these sort of one-piece white suits, and you wear a veil over your face. And I was, you know, quite compulsive and tucked in my, you know, my socks around my pants and made sure there were no orifices where the bees could get in. And I felt pretty safe. And, you know, we had a smoker, which you use to calm the bees down, and we did all the right things. And you know, you are in this sort of maelstrom of buzzing insects, but somehow I didn't feel threatened. Until I got myself in a bad position where I wasn't protected and the bees were really angry. And then you feel their wrath, for sure. So now when I see a bee, I am so excited that there is a bee there and it's doing its work. And, you know, normally I'm not disturbing their hives, so I'm not worried about getting stung. And I'm just happy that there's a bee alive in my yard and that it's doing its work pollinating flowers and making honey.
So the honeybees, those are the ones that are smaller, aren't they? I mean, I'm thinking my yard, I always get excited when I see the really big fuzzy ones, but those aren't the bees we're talking about.
Those are bumblebees.
What is the difference?
Bumblebees don't make honey. And I am not a bumblebee expert, so if there's someone out there who is, and please correct me if I'm wrong. But there are not as many of them. I don't believe they're solitary, but I think they have like, you know, they live in numbers that, you know, you can sort of count like 15 or 20 of them in, and I think they live in the ground. And I believe there are native bumblebees. And honeybees are not native to North America. So honeybees are, you know, much more social. They have these huge numbers. They're much more mobile. And, you know, they grow from, you know, 10,000 in wintertime to early spring to 60 to 80,000 at the height of summer. And they, because they make honey, they are able to build these huge structured hierarchical communities. And bumblebees are more lonesome creatures. They are social insects, but they're not as extremely social as honeybees, say.
Well, I want to get into some of the mechanics of the colony when we come back. As we talk this morning with Hannah Nordhaus, she's the author of the book, The Beekeeper's Lament, How One Man and Half a Million Bees Feed America. And we're happy to hear from you this morning, your questions about bees and colony collapse disorder at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234, or you can send your email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Veronica Rickert, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Veronica Rickert, back with you this morning on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're talking this hour about honeybees and the decline of honeybees as beekeepers struggle to keep up their hives and pollinate the crops in America. Our guest is Hannah Nordhaus. She's the author of The Beekeeper's Lament, How One Man and Half a Million Bees Help Feed America. And we have an email here from John in Milwaukee who says, I've read that there is speculation that cell phones are affecting bees. Is there any evidence supporting that theory?
Well, personally, I have found nothing very convincing. You know, every once in a while, a study comes out, or you know, some headlines hit the news about the fact that cell phone transmissions might lure bees away from their hives and to their deaths. And most recently, there was a flurry of headlines just in the last month or so, where a Swiss scientist found that cell phone transmissions disturb bees. And I, you know, read the study, and the guy actually put cell phones inside the beehives and then made them ring. And then his evidence that it disturbed bees is that the bees were upset for about 12 hours afterwards. And I don't find that at all surprising that having a ringing cell phone inside your beehive would upset you, you know, in the same way that having a ringing cell phone under your pillow might disturb your sleep. I don't think that necessarily proves that it's causing CCD or any of the other mortality. Beekeepers are always complaining about the fact that they have poor cell transmission in a lot of their bee yards, and they rarely, you know, whenever I went out to work the bees with John Miller, I never brought my phone because it's sort of useless when you've got, you know, a million bees buzzing around you. It's hard to hear. So nothing's ever persuaded me that that's the problem. I think there's a lot more convincing things out there that could be causing them to die, like the mites and
pesticides. That's one theory I've heard a lot of lately. How credible do you think the pesticide theory is?
I have a mixed response to what I've heard about pesticides. It seems entirely convincing that pesticides would be causing problems for bees. I'm sure they are, in fact. Pesticides are made to kill bugs. Bees are bugs. They do, you know, test these pesticides and claim that they aren't, and, you know, at the levels they're used, they don't affect bees. But there's some question as to whether, you know, at low levels, they don't necessarily kill bees outright, but they might accumulate in pollen and make them sick later. And particularly, there's this new class of pesticides called neonicotinoids, which are systemic pesticides that, you know, live in the plant. And that's been a real, you know, a lot of people think that's what's been causing CCD. You know, all their arguments are incredibly persuasive, but the science isn't there yet. There have been no studies that have shown that, in fact, they are causing CCD. So I think further study, you know, further examination into these pesticides is certainly warranted, and there's some question as to whether the EPA rushed the approvals through. There's been this memo that was leaked that showed that the EPA staff didn't think it was safe for bees, but approved some of these pesticides anyhow.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, so there's, you know, that's still up in the air, but, you know, a lot of people, there's been a couple books out that say definitively it's pesticides that's causing CCD, and I was not comfortable reaching that conclusion in my own book.
Let's take our first caller now. We've got Karen joining us from Milwaukee. Hi, Karen.
Hi. I just wanted to tell people about the possibility of them helping with the whole bee crisis by raising their own bees. My son and I did this last summer, and he's doing it again this summer. It was an amazing experience, not difficult or hard like the your guest is talking about, because we used a top bar hive. Anybody can do this. In their backyard, of course, you know, if the legality of it, it may be a question, but they have made beekeeping legal in Milwaukee now. And if you live, you know, in a farming community or a rural community, of course you could do it. But we just had the most incredible experience learning about bees. Like I said, it's a very easy process with this top bar hive.
And what is a top bar? Can I ask you, Karen, before we go any further, what is a top bar hive?
A top bar hive is different in that the other kind of hives that are stacked on top of each other are called Langstroth hives, and they are, you know, they take more work. So if you, as a single beekeeper, were thinking of doing that, it would take more of your time. A top bar hive, a friend of mine has developed a top bar hive with another friend of his, and their company is called BeePods, beepods.com. And the bees make their own comb on each little top bar that you put into the the unit. Mm-hmm. I always tell people it looks sort of like a little baby Jesus cradle. That's what the actual hive looks like, and it's really neat looking, actually beautifully designed. And so you have each little top bar, and the bees themselves make their own comb. Whereas in a Langstroth hive, you have the comb and it can be made out of plastic, whatever. Put in there. So the Langstroth hive is all about honey production. So with the top bar hive, you don't get as much honey, but it's a way of supporting the bees and, you know, keeping more bees around, pollinating everything. My garden did a whole lot better when we had the bees around. And we got at least 20 pounds of honey.
Great. Well, what about, Hannah, what Karen's saying? Maybe people should just take it upon themselves to have bee colonies in their front yards or backyards. Is that a movement?
Yeah, Karen, you're absolutely right. It is not hard to keep your own bees, and I did not mean to imply that in any way. Beekeeping is a great thing you can do to help bees, and everybody should have a hive in their yard. I don't, because I have really small children in a small yard, and it didn't seem like the right time to do it. But I someday intend to, and it is one way that everybody can pitch in, and you can then also witness this annual miracle of honey and bees pollinating gardens. The Langstroth hive isn't all that hard to use either. The reason it is endured for so long is that it is actually quite easy to use, and you don't have to destroy comb in order to make honey. But I'm talking about at the numbers that these commercial bee guys are doing. It's a hard life, not having your own one individual or two individual hives. But when you have 10,000, that's a lot of work. And top bar hives are even more work for these guys. I mean, you won't see a commercial beekeeper using a top bar hive because it doesn't produce as much honey, and it's just too hard to work with. But a lot of people think it's much better for keeping the bees healthy. And if that's your goal and you're not out trying to make a living selling honey, then that's certainly a great way to go. And I've heard a lot of good things about top bar hives. Backyard beekeeping is... It's very hip now. People are doing it all over. They're doing it in New York City. I live in Boulder, Colorado, and there are hives all over my neighborhood. And I've seen so many more bees than I used to. And it's a great way, to support the beekeeping industry, because then your healthy bees are intermingling with other people's healthy bees. And it's also, another good way is to buy local honey and help keep these guys afloat.
So if you are keeping your own bees in your backyard, is there a way for you to extract your own honey, or does it have to be processed somehow before you can eat it?
I don't know how small scale people do it, because I've only really worked with the big guys, and they have honey extractors, which are these little centrifugal machines. They're quite easy, and you just stick your honey frames in there, and it spins and the honey comes out, and then you can strain it, you can process it to whatever degree you want. John Miller, the guy in my book, heats his honey to sort of strain out the impurities. He doesn't, heat it so much that it pasteurizes, but he heats it to a little over, like 104 degrees or something like that. But I'm not quite sure how someone with one hive does it, if they each buy their own extractors, or if there's someone, you can go use somebody else's extractor to do it. So. I don't know.
I'm guessing there's some way to do it. It must be part of the benefit. And sometimes at the farmer's market, I've seen them selling little chunks of the comb that you can kind of suck the honey out of.
Yeah, you can, you can cut out the comb and with the honey intact, or you can spin it out with an extractor.
Well, let's take our next caller, and thank you to Karen. And now we go to Mark calling us from Marshfield. Welcome, Mark.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm kind of a Rambo gardener. I really, really enjoy gardening, and I've thought about beekeeping, since I was a kid, and just never really pulled the trigger. Your guest made a comment earlier on, and that intrigued me, though. She said that she became more aware of when she might get stung, and I'm not so much interested in behavior of a swarm or group of bees relative to that question, but more on the individual bee level, when you might, the behavior that bee might be exhibiting, where you might get stung. And I'll hang up, take my answer off the air, because I am calling on a cell phone and I don't want to upset any bees.
All right. Thanks, Mark. Hannah?
Well, thanks, Mark. It's a good question. Basically, if a bee is out working, it's not going to sting you. She's not going to sting you. She's busy, and she doesn't have to protect the hive. Bees sting in order to protect their home, their hive. So if you stumble upon a beehive, and there's a good chance, and they become aware of your presence, there's a good chance that you're going to get stung. But, if bees are in your garden, I my kids are always, pulling flowers that bees are sucking nectar from, and they... I have no fear for them, and they've never gotten stung. And the only time I've ever gotten stung was when I was like had my face in a beehive, or when the second time I got stung. I've only been stung twice, and it was 2 days in a row, or it was, you know, I guess there's one day in between the two stings. And the second time was I was not near a hive, but John Miller, the guy in my book, was dividing his hives. So he was taking all the bees away from their queen, killing the queens, and giving them new queens. And bees without queens are very agitated. So I was probably a couple of hundred yards away from where all the hives were, but there were, you know, easily a few million bees flying around in the air, and they were very upset. And if you're ever going to get stung, that's when bees lose their queen and their hive is threatened. So in your garden, just hanging out with bees there, I would have no concern at all.
One of the interesting factoids in your book is you give some advice on what to do if you are being targeted by an angry swarm of bees, maybe a queenless swarm. And I guess the thing to do is not to run around hysterically in circles.
Yeah. So the second time I was stung, that's exactly what I did. The first time it happened so fast, I didn't really, I was, you know, more affronted. I couldn't believe that this thing had just, you know, it was so peaceful, and suddenly this one angry bee came and stung me on the eye. Ugh. And then 2 days later was when I was, at John Miller's property, and he was dividing his hives, and a bee got in my hair, and so I pulled my veil over. It got in my hair and stung me, and I pulled my veil over because there were a bunch of bees around. I had sort of thought I was safely away from where the angry bees were, but I wasn't. And then there was another bee inside my veil, so suddenly I had two bees buzzing in my hair, and I just completely lost it and, you know, threw everything I was carrying down, my hat, my veil, my recorder, my pen, my notebook, and I just started running in circles, and I just didn't know what to do. And finally, one of his employees came and got me and brought me inside and pulled the stingers out of my hair. And so I guess, you know, the smartest thing to do is to get inside and to run away, straight away from the bees, rather than running in circles and, you know, looking agitated and attracting more attention. And I actually, in the book, I have this whole section where I talk with this insect sting expert, and he describes, you know, how much different insect stings hurt. And he mentioned that the stupidest thing you could possibly do when you're being harassed by bees is to jump into a body of water, because you go under and the bees just hang out up above the surface of the water waiting for you to come back up. And then when you do, they sting your mouth and nose, and then it gets even harder to breathe. So
bad.
Yeah, get inside and try to stay calm, but accept the fact that it's very hard to do when you're being stung, and especially when you have bees in your hair.
Well, thanks for doing the field research on bee stings for us.
Yeah,
so the rest of us can benefit.
Take it for the team.
Let's take another call now. Nikki joins us from Green Bay. Hi, Nikki.
Hello. I am a hobbyist beekeeper from in the Green Bay area. I've been keeping bees for about 7 years with my bee guru, Barry, who's out of Manitowoc, who's been kind enough to help me. In just a comment about bee stings, I've been stung so many times I can't count. And I find that it doesn't really hurt that much. I think probably if you psych yourself up, it hurts a lot worse. And the most important thing is to take your fingernail and get that stinger out of your skin, because as long as a stinger is in your skin, it keeps pumping venom into your body from the venom sac, which comes away from the bee's body after she stings you. And then secondly, you were talking about extractors. For a hobbyist beekeeper, somebody who doesn't keep that many hives, you can get hand-cranked extractors, and you can also get electric extractors that will extract four frames, six frames. They're not very expensive. You can get them through companies like Daydant, or I think some people pronounce it Daydant, and a place called Better Bee online. And they're not too bad. They run, I think, maybe between $200 and $1,000, depending on whether you want the hand crank system or the electric system. I keep natural bees, so I don't use any chemicals. I try to feed honey back to the hive because I've heard that and I've read a little bit that it's more nutritious for the honeybees to eat their own honey than to eat sugar water. And I'm wondering if your guest has anything, any research that would help me determine whether that's true or not.
Okay, thanks. Thanks, Nikki. Hannah?
Yeah, it's absolutely true. Honey is the best thing for bees to eat. And John Miller, the beekeeper in my book, used to strip a lot more honey from his hives at the end of the season, and then he'd feed them corn syrup or sugar syrup to tide them over until the next bloom. And one of the things he's realized in these last, you know, 5 to 10 few horrible years of beekeeping is that nutrition is really important. And now he leaves his hives a lot heavier. So I think he used to have his hive weigh 100 pounds, and that's about like 50 pounds of equipment and then 50 pounds of honey. And now he leaves 70 pounds of honey, so 120-pound hive each winter, and so that they're eating the real stuff. He does still have to supplement mainly because of almond pollination. He has to wake them up so early, and there's nothing blooming. And he used to give them corn syrup, and now he only gives them beet sugar syrup instead. He's very anti-corn syrup, and I think a lot of beekeepers are reaching the same conclusion. Sugar costs more, but it's better than corn syrup, and honey is absolutely the best thing.
So you said wake them up. Are they actually hibernating then?
They're dormant. So they're not hibernating, but he keeps them in these potato cellars, as I said, and they're 47 degrees. They're right at a temperature where bees it's not so cold that they have to work really hard to stay warm, and when they work hard, they have to eat more, so that sort of preserves their stores of honey for the winter. And it's ventilated so that they don't get nasty diseases or suffocate. And they just, when it's wintertime, they cluster up in a little ball and keep each other warm and eat honey they sort of flap their wings in order to keep the hive warm when it gets really cold, and they eat honey to keep their energy up. And so slowly through the winter, they go through their stores of honey. So they're not asleep necessarily, but they're not out gathering and flying and scouting and foraging and all that. They're just resting.
Sleepy bees.
Yeah, so in February, they should still be resting, and these bee guys get them up and bring them to California, and they have to work really hard in the almonds, and it's pretty hard on the organism of the hive.
We're talking this hour with Hannah Nordhaus. She's the author of the book, The Beekeeper's Lament, How One Man and Half a Million Bees Help Feed America. And we'd love to hear from more of you today, your questions and your comments about keeping bees and maybe about colony collapse disorder. Our number is 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. And you can send your email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Veronica Rickert, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Veronica Rickert with you this morning on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour, we're talking about bees and beekeeping with Hannah Nordhaus, the author of The Beekeeper's Lament. And before we go too much farther, I do want to make sure we talk about the inner life of these colonies, because it's fascinating. Can you tell us about how a colony functions?
Yeah, so everybody knows there's this queen bee who's sort of, I say in the book, she's both its ruler but also the captive of the hive. She lays all the eggs, and basically the rest of the colony's function is to keep her alive and then keep the brood, the eggs that she lays, alive as well. So she lays the eggs. They start out as these little rice-shaped, oblong rice-shaped things, and they are in the bottom of the cell, so there's the hexagonal cells that you see in the honeycomb. And the nurse bees, they put some food in there, some honey, royal jelly, and then they cap it off, and then the eggs develop into larvae and then into pupae, which are like little white proto-bees. And then when they are ready, they eat their way out of the cell, and then they become nurse bees, so they take care of the other eggs as they hatch. And then they graduate to being guards and foragers, and the guards are the ones who sort of sting you when you come too close to the hive. The foragers are the ones who do all the work, and they go out and gather the honey and the gather the nectar and the pollen and come back and turn it into honey. And then there's the nurse bees also attend to the queen, so they make sure that she's fed, and as she just goes and she just drops her butt in these little cells and lays more eggs. And the queen can lay up to 3,000 eggs a day. So
wow.
It's very finely tuned hierarchical city of insects, and they're all working for one goal, which is sort of the perpetuity of the hive, keeping it alive and keeping the queen going and keeping the eggs fed and the honey gathered and storing for the future.
It's not always a great life for the queen either. She lays eggs, and sure, she gets doted on for most of her life, but the minute she stops laying eggs, it sounds like the other bees kind of rip her apart.
Yeah, they trade her in for a newer model. Once they realize the queen's failing, they feed royal jelly, which is a special substance, to developing larvae, and then they, instead of becoming worker bees, which can't lay eggs, they become queens, which have fully functioning ovaries and can lay. Some worker bees can actually lay drone. I didn't even mention the drones. The drones are the males, and they just hang out and get fed and wait to mate with the queen. So some worker bees can lay drone eggs, but only the queen can lay female eggs, which are really the heart of the colony. And so she just lays eggs all day until she stops being a good queen, and then everybody sets on her and tears her wings off and throws her out. And she, they raise these new queens, and they raise a few of them, and the first one to come out usually eats her way out and then kills all the other ones, all the other queens, and takes over the colony.
I don't know. So much for thinking bees are noble creatures.
Yeah. No, it's a dog-eat-dog world out there. They are noble, but they also want to make sure they survive.
Right. Well, let's take another phone call now. Dennis joins us from Sister Bay. Hi, Dennis.
Hi. I suppose my attraction to being a hobby beekeeper was the abject fascination and spiritual experience of working with these little buggers. You will get stung. It only hurts for a little while. And you can curse them and say, yeah, I give you a nice house and you sting me. How could you dare do that? One of the experiences that I'm reflecting on now is just sitting in front of a hive on a nice warm day with good weather and maybe my face a foot or two from the entrance and just marveling at how this city was working. And of course they weren't bothering me and I wasn't bothering them. One of the things that your listeners might consider doing if they live in an area where they could join a beekeepers association. That's how I got started. I was in Illinois at the time and joined the Cook DuPage Beekeepers Association. I'm an old timer now, but at that time there were lots of old time beekeepers who had manifest experience in keeping bees. And those were the people that I really learned from. With regard to working a hive, do it on a nice day. There's no inclement weather coming, and you basically can do it unprotected. At least they would, and I experienced that as well. If it looks like it's going to storm, be careful. But anyway, for all of those of you who are interested in doing it, it is just wonderful.
Well, thank you, Dennis. Thank you for calling with those beekeeping insights. It was interesting how Dennis referred to the beekeeping as spiritual, and also his second point there about getting involved with an association of beekeepers who can help you out.
Yeah, other callers said beekeeping, it is easy, but there's a lot of easier things like watching TV and eating ice cream and. I mean, it's something you do because it calls to you, and everybody. I love beekeepers. I mean, I just did a talk in Boulder, Colorado, where I live last night, and the head of the Boulder Beekeepers Association came, and he's the last apiary inspector in the state of Colorado. Just this wonderful guy, and every time I meet these old-time beekeepers, they're just great people. They're so interesting to talk to, and I don't know if it, why that is, that, you know, it's people who are drawn to this sort of hard thing. I say in the book, you know, I mean, one of the reasons that I wrote this book is, you know, I am very interested in bees, but I'm also very interested in people who persist in doing this difficult thing in this age of convenience. I mean, we all have iPhones and everything's so at your fingertips, yet these guys are still basically doing the same thing that, hey, John Miller is a fourth-generation beekeeper. His great-grandfather did the same thing. He used the Langstroth hive, the exact same kind of hive, the bellows smoker, like all the same equipment, based the same white suit. And it hasn't changed that much. It's this very 19th-century practice, and it's incredibly important to modern agriculture, and it's just, you know, and to how our gardens flourish and to all the honey that I like to eat. So I, one of the reasons I wrote the book is I just, you know, a love letter to these beekeepers, because we can't thank them enough.
Now that you've really dug into this subject and gotten to know bees and beekeeping and honey, can you taste the difference in all the different varieties of honey? You know, our farmers market has some honey guys, and they have maybe 15, 20 different kinds of honey. Can you tell the difference now?
Yeah. I'd like to consider, I don't keep bees, so I can't consider myself really an expert on bees. I have learned a lot, but not keeping them myself, I can't ever claim expertise on that subject, but I do like to think I'm an expert on honey now. I have sampled a lot of it as research for this book, and that was another draw because I have a major sweet tooth, and you can really tell the difference once you dig in. You know, most of the supermarket honeys are blends. Usually clover and alfalfa honeys, which are lighter, milder honeys that are grown, that are produced in northern tier states like North Dakota, where John Miller is, and Wisconsin and Minnesota. And then they usually blend it with darker southern honey. So it's got this sort of generic honey taste to some degree. But if you get into the varietals, so to speak, it's just amazing how they taste. John Miller and my now favorite honey is star thistle honey, which is, star thistle is this nasty, noxious weed that grows along roadsides. And it just makes the most wonderful honey. Miller describes it as tasting like a wall of sunshine in your mouth.
You
know, it doesn't have, some honey has this sort of really strong aftertaste, and some of the really good honeys, and most of them come from weeds, are they just taste like flowers smell. They're just so wonderful.
Now you're making me want honey.
Good stuff.
Yeah, it is beautiful stuff, and as you point out, it can last for decades or centuries.
Yeah, you know, some honey granulates, some honey doesn't, but honey rarely, if ever, spoils. It's pretty amazing stuff.
Let's see if we have time for one more quick call. Charlie from Milwaukee, you're next. And if you could keep your comments short, please.
Hey, Veronica.
Hey.
I was calling in response to the top bar hive and how you harvest from it. We are top bar hive keepers in Milwaukee. We make top bar hives, teach people how to do it. And as far as the harvesting is concerned, it's real easy. There's two ways. You can either put it inside of a Ziploc storage bag and pound the honey until it comes out of the wax, and the wax is higher than or lighter than the honey, so the wax goes up, the honey goes down, you cut a corner, and it pours into a jar. You can just put a little sieve underneath it and catch it. The other thing that we encourage people to do is to just eat it. Wax is good for you, believe it or not.
Eat the wax.
Yeah, if you eat the beeswax with the honey in it and some of the other things that are in it, like the pollens, it's actually very healthy for you. It lowers your cholesterol, and it's very high in antioxidants. And believe it or not, Wrigley's Spearmint Gum or Wrigley's Chewing Gum back in the 1920s, the first thing on their ingredient list was beeswax.
Really? Huh. And is it, you know, palatable going down the hatch?
Well, when it's mixed up with all of the honey, it is, definitely. If you keep on chewing it for quite a while, eventually it'll get to a point where it begins to granulate a little bit, and so then you'll probably want to spit it out. But if you eat it all at once, it's very healthy and very good. It's even when you mash it in that bag, it's good to cook with, just like that. If you need a sweetener, you just put it all in there. The thing that's cool about it is that the pollens are in there as well, and the pollens are terrific at making you lose your allergies if you've got local allergies.
Great. Well, that's fascinating. Thank you so much, Charlie. Those are really interesting things there. And Hannah, we're almost out of time, but I want to ask you one last question. We've got about 30 seconds for your answer. Having done all this research and seen what you've seen about the deaths of honeybees, are you still optimistic about their survival?
Oh, that's a good question. You know, I guess I am, and the reason I am is because of these beekeepers, because these people are so dedicated. And again, it's not easy. It's not getting easier, but there are all these, you know, devoted beekeepers who are determined, bound and determined to find a way to keep their bees alive. And there's more and more hobbyist beekeepers who are pitching in. And, you know, bees have never been more popular, I don't think. So I think that with, you know, we'll figure it out. We'll find a way to keep them alive.
All right. Well, Hannah, it's been so much fun to talk with you today. Thank you so much for being on with us.
Thanks, Veronica. It was great.
Hannah Nordhaus, the author of The Beekeeper's Lament, How One Man and Half Million Bees Help Feed America. And thanks to Rhonda Fanning for production this morning, and thanks to you for listening. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.